When disinformation goes viral, it's not an accident. It's basically marketing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech, Demystifying the Digital Economy. I'm Molly Wood. If you've gone on the internet in the past week, you've probably heard about Plandemic. It's a viral video full of misinformation about the coronavirus. It features a discredited scientist who accuses people like Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH and Bill Gates of using the COVID-19 outbreak to seize political power. YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter have been trying to chase the video off the internet, but experts who follow disinformation say it's not an accident that it got so big in the first place. It's an old playbook that's even more effective in a time of fear and uncertainty. Renee Diresta is the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. She studies discourse online.
In the most recent viral misleading video that went up on Facebook, you know, there was a strong marketing component to it because one of the people involved had a book to sell. What you see is the same text will be used, you know, it'll be kind of a particular core message produced, almost the way that you would see from a PR team, where the message goes out alongside the link. And there's a real attempt to get it all out at right around the same time in hopes that you can kind of trick one of the algorithms that amplifies popular content on platforms into thinking that it's seeing something that's organic and a simultaneous outpouring of organic interest in a person or topic.
What role do other influencers play in getting this into the mainstream? Like, is part of the campaign to have a list of sort of ideal influencers that you would love to get to retweet your content?
Yes, absolutely. If you get it to a sufficient number of blue check accounts that have 1 million, 2 million followers or audience members, you've really ensured that you're reaching an existing mass audience. People think that those accounts are more authoritative. A trusted influencer with a large audience really does a lot to both reach people and also create an environment in which the information is coming from someone that you trust.
How can journalists avoid amplifying these claims? Like, what is the right response to a coordinated misinformation strategy? And how do you even identify it quickly enough?
With regard to this particular video that went viral with the discredited scientist, that was actually the third or fourth video that had been posted to YouTube that did get significant traction. And so those of us who watch the anti-vaccine and health misinformation communities, really, this was like a train wreck in very, very, very slow motion. You know, people had seen indications that this marketing effort was really trying to turn her into an influencer. The problem was nobody wanted to write the story, including researchers, because you don't want to give it oxygen if it's just going to stay confined to the communities that are the natural sort of affinity places for it. And then you see the debunking pieces begin to go up, but because it takes time for journalists to write those articles, they usually don't go up for 6 hours, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is, at that point, the viral information has had a chance to really sit with people for, you know, a couple of days, and the correction is not going to go as far as it did. Mm-hmm. This is where I do think that platforms bear a little bit more responsibility in terms of when you begin to see a video or a post or repetitive content about a person begin to gain traction in what looks like an inauthentic or coordinated way, that's where there's an opportunity to kind of temporarily throttle while you have the fact checker go and look and see what kind of information this is and how it should be dealt with.
Got it. Are you saying that platforms may have the technology or just the eyes on to be able to get to it more quickly?
You can begin to see when velocity of mentions is what it's called sometimes, beginning to do well. You know, if Coca-Cola is all of a sudden mentioned 500 times in a minute, it'll flag it for their brand monitoring people who will then go and look and see what's going on. So these tools for social listening and understanding that kind of dynamic, they do exist.
Got it. Let's say the content gets taken down, in which case the conspiracy theorist becomes a digital martyr. Like, is one of the goals actually to be taken down so that then you can claim that you were censored?
Well, what we saw in the prior takedowns of this video that achieved mass appeal was actually the third video in which they declare exactly what you've said, that someone somewhere is trying to keep people from knowing the truth. That's why in some cases, the better response is rather than doing the takedown, just ensuring that the accurate information is attached as quickly as possible.
what are the opportunities in this time exactly? Because, you know, obviously there have been a lot of conversations about misinformation, about manipulating platforms. Platforms have tried to take a hands-off approach, and they're now essentially saying, you know, the virus is a clear and present public health danger. We can act more aggressively because the benefits are indisputable from a health perspective. Does that give us an opportunity for research or lasting change or data or really understanding misinformation better?
Well, some of the work that we're doing at Stanford actually looks at the initial application of those policies. So the coronavirus misinformation policy is an extension of policies that were put in place in 2019 related to the measles outbreaks that were repeatedly happening. When the Brooklyn measles outbreak struck, the platforms did begin to take steps to reduce the amount of reach that anti-vaccine groups were getting. And they did that in some very basic ways. They stopped promoting them in the recommendation engine. They stopped accepting money to run ads on their behalf. The challenge, the interesting thing that we've seen come out of this is that the policies were designed to amplify the CDC and the World Health Organization and their information. But during the coronavirus, there was the additional challenge of health institutions trying to figure out what was going on at the same time as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't always great information to be amplifying because with something like hydroxychloroquine and whether it works, a scientific authority isn't going to come out with a strong, firm judgment on that prior to the research being done. And so there's this gap where people really want information, but the science isn't there yet. And so what fills the void is whatever any random person, you know, with a sufficiently large audience produces about hydroxychloroquine. And so there's just not a whole lot of authoritative information for the platforms to be amplifying. So this has been an interesting time with just understanding how, you know, how do you get information to the public when there's no information?
Renee DiResta studies online discourse at the Stanford Internet Observatory. And now for some related links. In news you can hopefully use if you don't find yourself too enraged by the level of willful conspiracy believing from your friends and family on Facebook, The Atlantic has a piece from last week on what to say to people who share links to things like the plandemic video or other debunked disinformation. It does say that you will have the most luck with people who are curious or uncertain, wondering if a thing could possibly be true. And it says you should try to empathize with the fear and uncertainty. And, quote, don't lecture someone, don't get exasperated, don't insult them, and don't try to refute specific falsehoods. Which, no, I hear you. This is at times a gargantuan task, and I will forgive you if sometimes you just have to walk away. There's a link to that piece on our website, marketplacetech.org. Also, a link to the piece about how Twitter said Monday that it will warn users when tweets contain information that's either in dispute or could be misleading, and try to link to additional context when appropriate. Twitter said it will try to remove posts only when they're deemed to be actually harmful. One part of this story, as yet unexplored, it seems, is Amazon's role in the disinformation ecosystem. That debunked scientist who stars in the plandemic videos is, as Renee DiResta said, selling a book. That book is number 5 on Amazon's bestseller list at the time I'm writing this. It's been as high as number 1 in recent days. Amazon has come under fire before for promoting books that contain health-related misinformation. Last year, Amazon removed some books that claim to cure autism. But the company told a Wired UK reporter that this book does not violate its content guidelines. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.